Morning, Romans chapter 3 and verse 9. Romans 3 and verse 9. We're ready now to look at the final part of God's case against man, and it's Romans 3, verses 9 through verse 20, God's case against man, the summation. Romans 3, beginning with verse 9 down through verse 20, is going to bring it all together. And we start out with the first caption, and that is the scene. How should we picture Romans 3, verses 9 through 20. The basic scene is courtroom. All of the elements that you would see, or the majority of the elements you would see, in a courtroom procedure are found in Romans 3, 9 through 20. We briefly went through them when we closed our last lesson, but let's see them, and then we'll do the details under it. First of all, in the courtroom scene, the charge. And the charge is seen in chapter 3 and verse 9. What then? Are we better than they? No, not at all. For we have already charged. You see why I've called this summation? Paul says, I've already done my job. 1:18 down through chapter 3 verse 8 has made the case that God has against all men. And he's established that all men are sinners, all men are guilty, all men are therefore under the wrath of God. And he says, I've done that. I'm ready now to bring you to the summation of what I've already done. So what then? Are we better than they? The we would be we who are Jews. Better than they, those who are not Jews. Not at all. For we have already charged that both Jews and Greeks are, and here is the charge, all under sin. And at this point, for the first time in the book of Romans, and we'll underscore it, you have the noun sin. He has shown that men are sinners to this point, but only now does he use the noun sin. And that might be a little bit of surprise, because you go through Romans 1, chapter 1, and chapter 2, and into chapter 3, and he's naming sins one by one. You come down to the end of chapter 1, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful. But not at this point does he use the noun sin to describe men. This is the first time, and therefore the charge is an umbrella charge. All are under sin. The charge is followed with the details of what we will call the indictment. The indictment has two characteristics. Number one, it is written. And in one sense, it's not really Paul's indictment. It's the indictment that he derives from two places. He derives it from the book of Psalms. And he derives it from the book of Isaiah. And out of these two books, the indictment is 14 points. The 14 points of indictment begin with chapter 3 and verse 10. As it is written. And as it is written introduces the indictment. And then through the following context, you have quotations taken from the Psalms and taken from the book of Isaiah, and they all back up the charge by saying, all are under sin. Now let me give you the 14-point indictment. And there are 14 points in this section. As soon as the indictment is made, obviously, the one indicted should have a chance to respond. So, third is the defense. And the defense is 319A. the defense is really no defense. The defense is really man saying, I have nothing to say. So verse 19 begins by reading, now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under law, that every mouth may be stopped. So the defense is every mouth stopped. In other words, nobody has anything to say. The earth stands absolutely silent. So the defense, or we might say the absence of the defense, and you simply picture the one who's been accused, charged, indicted, simply hangs his head and says, I have nothing to say. I have no defense. And that's where verse 19a takes us. Every mouth stopped. That is then followed by the verdict. And that really is in two parts. First of all, it gets announced. And it is announced in 19b. All the world may become accountable to God. And we'll work with that word accountable when we get to it. It means answerable. It means that God has been offended and some payment must be made to him. The world accountable to God. Now, you might think that at the end of verse 19 that Paul would end everything, because that really does wrap it up. The world is guilty before God. That verdict is announced, and you might think that Paul would stop there. However, if every mouth is stopped, and every mouth says the verdict is right and just and in harmony with what really ought to be, what is man then likely to do? I've offended God. I'm under his wrath. I am guilty. Now, where does the human mind go? Well, now let's do something to correct the situation. And so Paul says, by taking the verdict and then supporting the verdict, my support for the verdict is going to say, whatever you may be thinking as a way out, and I know what you're thinking, you're going to be good from now on, aren't you? So he said, let's slam the final door, and that's verse 20. He says, because by the works of the law, no flesh shall be justified in his sight. So if you're thinking you're now going to be a good boy, you're now going to keep the law, then you need to know something else. That's no way out either. Because by the works of the law, verse 20, no flesh shall be justified in his sight, for through the law comes the knowledge of sin. So he's going to say the verdict is you're guilty. Slam the door by saying whatever you think might be the door out is closed. So the support says there is no way out. Reformation, keeping the law, being good, is not your solution. And that is the way he closes out with verse 20. Now, if we really felt the force down through verse 20, we will stand helpless and hopeless. All ears when Paul begins to say, now let me point you to the only possible solution, and it's justification by faith. And that will begin in chapter 3, verse 21. We may get to that today, but this is where we're going in this particular section. So, first thing then is somewhat of a construction of the scene. Second, and this is all introductory to it, second, notice that in Romans 3, 9 through 20, Paul brings all men together. All men are brought together. Now, he didn't do that previously. Previously, he said, are you the one that calls yourself the Jew? And then he deals with the Jew. He begins chapter 2 and verse 1 by saying, every one of you who passes judgment. And he's talking about the moralist. In chapter 1, he's talking about the heathen. And so his method is to indict the heathen, 1:18 down through the end of chapter 1, verse 32. Then the moralist, 2:1 through 16. Then the religious, 2:17 through chapter 3 and verse 8. And when he has done that, he says, now in my summation, I want to pick up all of you and bring you all together. So, notice, coming down to 3:9, what then? Are we better than they? Not at all. For we have already charged both Jews and Greeks are all under sin, and he's going to pull us together. And in doing so, he is going to answer two questions. And the first one is this. In the whole world, how many righteous people are there? How many righteous in the whole world, how many righteous are there? And then he will turn over and say, let's do the other side of the coin. How many sinners are there? But first, how many righteous are there is answered in this context. And notice, almost like a drumbeat, his answer is none, 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 none. So, verse 10, as it is written, there is none righteous, not even one. There is none who understands. There is none who seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they have become useless. There is none who does good. And there is not even one. So our answer then, repeatedly, to the question, how many righteous are there, is none. Dash. Not even one. And if anyone would like to accept themselves to that, then you have an enormous battle to do with the text. Because it's almost as though you want to edit this down and make it a little bit shorter by saying, Paul, you said there is none righteous once. Then you added not even one. And then you kicked us two more times by saying none, none. Then you come down to verse 12 and says there's none who does good. And then you're not satisfied with that. You have to add to that not even one. So there is little question about the answer. How many righteous are there? Is none. Two. How many sinners are there? Number two. How many sinners are there? And having answered the other side of the thing, it wouldn't be difficult to answer this side of it. In other words, we don't even have to look at the text to get the answer to how many sinners are there. Because we've already had it. But just in case we slept through the nuns and the not even ones, Paul says, let me come back and notice in verses 9, 12, and 19, he uses the word all. Verse 9, what then? Are we better than they? Not at all, for we have charged that both Greeks and Jews and Greeks are all under sin. So notice the charge. The charge says all under sin. And then you come to verse 12. They have turned aside. Together they have become useless. Verse 12. All have turned aside. Together they become useless. So you've got all under sin in verse 9. You've got all have turned aside in verse 12. And then when you come down to verse 19, now we know that whatever the law says, it says, speaks to those who are under the law, that every mouth may be closed and all the world become guilty with God. So I would take the word all in verse 9, the word all that begins verse 12, and the word all the world in verse 19. So really he structured it fairly neatly. He begins with the charge, all under sin. And then he ends with all the world is accountable before God. All have sinned, all are accountable. All have sinned, all are guilty. All are under the penalty of sin. All are under the condemnation of sin. It's a bottom line. This is where we are in Romans chapter 3 as he begins with verse 9 through 20, which is the summation. And really, you can take the summation and there's no question about it. But remember, Paul has backed up his summation by his argument. And therefore, if we would say that this is summation, which is adequate, we also ought to remember that the summation has been based on two chapters of argumentation. He's taken two chapters to prove it, to teach it, to argue it, to look at every class, to look at those who are deep in the committal of sins, and then to look at those on the side that are pointing the finger and saying, "Yay, Paul, we agree with you. You're absolutely right." Paul wipes them out. And then over on this section, he has those that are holding their Bibles high, saying, "This is where we stand." And Paul turns to them, as we studied last time in Romans chapter 2 and 3, beginning with verse 17 of chapter 2, and he wipes them out. The heathen, the moralist, the Bible wavers. And there's nobody left. And so he says in chapter 3, "I'm ready to draw the bottom line. All are under sin. And I will argue that from verses 9 down through verse 20. And I will use verse after verse after verse after verse. And will be able to do this. I will be able to say, now look, if you think this is my own personal argument, if you think that this is only Paul, please, with verse 10, let me stand to the side and say, as it is written." And we will let those that hold their Bibles go to the book of Psalms. And the book of Psalms that is found in the Bible that you hold indicts you. And then we will allow you that would herald the prophets to go to the prophets, and we'll go to Isaiah and say the prophets indict you. So everybody is indicted in Romans chapter 1 through chapter 3:20. And again, we ought to make application. This is Paul's approach to salvation. This is his approach to the basic doctrine of Christianity, which is justification by faith. But where does Paul start? He starts with man's helpless, hopeless condition. That is where all true evangelism starts. That is the basis of it. That's where the Holy Spirit started, and that's where we ought to start. So let's begin now with the analysis. And we'll break those things down into, as we've seen, an overview, the charge. There is almost no comparison between evangelism, in quotes, as we see it today, and Pauline evangelism, which really means there's very little link between evangelism as we know it today and biblical evangelism. And that's the purpose for studying the book of Romans. So chapter 3, now verse 9, beginning with the charge. And he begins with two questions to open it up. The first is, what then? What then? First of all, we'll underscore the little word then, and note that then is called an inferential particle. It is an inferential particle. It means I'm giving you a little flag. And the flag that I put up says you must conclude something now. You must now, at this point, come to a conclusion. That's a unique feature of the New Testament. That's a unique feature of Paul's teaching we need to stop and think about for just a moment. Because Paul does not just throw it out there and say, now, you go home and you think on this and you decide for yourself what you ought to conclude. He will put out the information and say, you must now come to a conclusion. And do his following words seem to intimate, go home and think about it? No, they don't intimate that at all. Whenever Paul says it's time to come to a conclusion, guess who makes the conclusion? He makes that too. And therefore, when we say he makes that too, it's the Holy Spirit really saying, I've argued, I've proved, it's time for a decision. It's time to conclude something in your mind. It's time to put something together. And I want you to think about that. And now I'm going to tell you what you ought to conclude. So it's conclusion time is this. Now, when he says you must come to a conclusion, how far back is he going? Is he saying the last sentence I said called for a decision or a conclusion? Well, this goes back, or the length, I guess we could put it, backwards, reached by the then, is 1:18 through 3:20. So the then found in this verse is a pretty big one. and extends back a long ways. Maybe we could make it easier if we would say with this, the what then is what follows. What is logical? What is true? What is to be believed? And all of that is wrapped up in what then? What follows? What is the logical conclusion? What are we to conclude is true? What are we now to believe? And that all comes in under those words. First question, we got to make a conclusion. Second question is, are we better than they? And the, are we better than they, I take it would be this. Paul is joining with these fellow Jews. Are we Jews better than they, all others, or any others? The division of the world then was basically Jew and Gentile. And therefore the question is, are we as Jews better than they, that is, the rest of the world? And to that he brings to a quick conclusion by saying, not at all. Now, does that bother you? It really should. You all, really, if you've been following Romans, that ought to really give you a problem right there. Are we, Jews, better than they? And he says, none. No way. Doesn't that bother you? What did we just study? Go back to chapter 2. Or 3, rather, at the beginning of the chapter. And that ought to really raise a problem of consistency. Because 3 began by saying, what then advantage has the Jew? Or what benefit is circumcision? Great in every respect. Now, how do you harmonize what advantage has the Jew? Great in every respect of chapter 3. And chapter 3 and verse 9. Are we better than they? Not at all. So how do we harmonize and reconcile the two answers to the question? And so he has basically said, are Jews at an advantage? And he has given us two answers. 3:1, in every way, they have an advantage. Chapter 3 and verse 9, not at all. So how do we bring into harmony the two questions that have been asked within a few breaths of Paul's teaching, or between chapter 3, verse 1, and chapter 3 and verse 9? The difference is this. The what advantage does the Jew have? And he answers in every way. He's talking about their distinctive position. In 3:9, he's talking about their spiritual fitness. And therefore, if you would say, what advantage does the Jews say? Well, as far as their position is concerned, they have the law. They have other things, and they have a unique and a distinctive and an advantageous position. But if you're saying, how are they better, and you're talking about their spiritual fitness, then they are no different than the moral man. They're no different than the heathen, and all men are on an equal plane. So keep in mind then, Paul is looking at two things. We could illustrate it. Here we sit, and we can illustrate it easily from right here. Here we sit with Bibles open in front of us. In Africa, you may have someone who has never heard or seen of a Bible ever. Do we have an advantage? Sure we do. We have more light than they do. But have we sinned like they have sinned? Yes. And therefore, what advantage do we have? We have a great one in that we possess more light. But they possess less light. So more light, less light in terms of position. So distinctive position would be, if you've got more light, you're better off. And if you have less light, you are less better off than that other person. However, if you're going to measure each one by the light possessed, what's the bottom line? There's no difference. The one that has much light has sinned against light. The one who has a little light has sinned against light. And the one who has only the light of nature has sinned against light. So it makes no difference how much truth we possess. So the distinctive position was in the amount of truth possessed. And that is a great advantage. But if we sin against it, the bottom line is still the same as we come over to chapter 3 and verse 9. All right, continuing on in the passage, 3:9. What are we to conclude then? Are we Jews better than everybody else in terms of spiritual fitness and our standing before God, in terms of what we've done with life? Answer, not at all. For we have already charged, and the word charged is an important word to stop on. The word charged refers to two things. Number one, the content of 1:18 through 3:20. And second, the word was used of making a charge in court. The word charged is a courtroom word. It's official, it's legal, it's what they would recognize out of their own vocabulary and their own understanding. So this is the charge. He's not going to repeat it. The charge was in the form of argumentation. And it was full of argumentation. Paul would say, don't you see this? Haven't you understood this? Don't you know this? And if you disagree, let me show you how you're wrong. We went over that in some detail last time, how Paul assumed in his audience there were people that would not agree with him. And he always went after them. He always said, I know what you're thinking, but let me bring you back in the light of what is really true. So Paul is saying, that's all behind us, that's all taken place, and it's all concluded and put together. Now, the words, all under sin, which is the charge, in summation form. The all under sin is very important. All under sin is very important. First of all, let's compare Romans 1:18 through 3:8. And the essence of that section has been to describe man's condition. Romans 1:18 described man's condition. And he does it very carefully, very vividly, and very clearly. Romans 3:9 is the first time, however, that Paul says, I'm finished describing and I'm ready to name. So 3:9 now names man's condition. The naming case is what? Or when we talk about naming something, we're talking about noun. He names man's condition. And really, what he does is he turns the verb and the adjective of 1:8 through 3:8 and now turns it all into a noun. And the noun is all are under sin. Notice, by the way, what Paul does not say. In chapter 3, verse 9, he does not say, what then, are we better than they? Not at all, for we've already charged that both Jews and Greeks are sinners. He doesn't say that. That's not the wording, and we need to be careful with it. He does not say, all men are sinners, though that's true. But that's not what he says. He does not say, all are guilty. Though that too is true, but that's not what he says. He does not say all men sinned. This is not Romans 3:23 that says, for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. And all have sinned is not the same as all are under sin. And when we look at that phrase, it becomes extremely important by what it says. So let me give it in a general form and then we'll specify it. all men are under sin in this way. We're under sin and all that goes with it. Under sin and everything that goes with it. You say, what do you mean, all that goes with it? Well, that is really a fundamental thing we ought to know, because remember, the first thing that Satan ever did with Eve said, there's nothing that goes with sin. There's nothing that accompanies it. It can be done and nothing will happen. God had said, in the day that you eat, that's the sin, because it was contrary to His will. Did anything go with it? You will surely die. So notice, there's always something that goes. And Satan comes along and says, has God said that if you do this particular thing, that you will die? It won't happen. Nothing goes with sin. And Satan's whole attempt, right here, put an arrow up to it. Satan's whole attempt is to split off these two things. Satan's attempt comes right there. His attempt is to wipe out the rest of the sentence. Go ahead and sin. Go ahead and do what you will, irrespective of the will of God, and nothing will happen. But that is not true. What goes with sin? Number one, you cannot sin without guilt. When we sin, we are guilty. Once Adam and Eve sinned, something else went with sin. They couldn't stop. There is the power of it. And if you debate number one, that sin has any power, try to stop. Just try to stop. And you'll find that we continue to sin, and there's something in man that's part of his nature that sins and sins and sins. We can cover it. We can try to argue that we don't, but we do. Unless we're willing to say that I live a life that is in total compliance with the will of God, I never have a thought, I never have an action that displeases Him in any way. And that is not true. That's Satan's lie once again, trying to make us think that nothing goes with sin. So you've got the power of it. You can't sin without the penalty going with it. And there we are. All of this is under sin. So when we say in Romans 3:9 that all are under sin, we mean all that under sin and everything that goes with it, such as guilt, such as its inescapable power, such as its penalty. And the average person never, ever takes it seriously. Really? Who takes it seriously? So what? There must be a crack somewhere. There must be some way that I'll get through the door. And that is what Romans is arguing. There is no way out. And really, if from the taking out, there is no more horrifying thought, and I'm speaking even from an emotional standpoint, that ought to literally scare us to death, is to remove the cross and look in the mirror. So there's no hope. No hope whatsoever. And that's where Paul is arguing, and that is what he is bringing us to in this particular context. Now, we're just a few minutes earlier. However, I want to start the indictment clean in the next hour. So let's put our next point will be, understand, let me give you the 14-point indictment. Chapter 3 of Romans, verses 10 through 18. And of these 14 accounts, we'll divide them, because I think there is a fair division. The first one involves the extent of sin. 3:10-12. And it's hard to miss, isn't it? There is none, not even one. Notice this, the underscoring of extent of sin, which is in number one. Then in the following verses 13 through 18, we will have the depth of sin. And it will be explained to us under six metaphors: throat, tongue, lips, mouth, feet, eyes. That's interesting. Do you see any pattern there? Throat, tongue, lips, mouth, feet, and eyes. Throat, lips, tongue, mouth. Throat, lips, tongue, mouth. It's Dr. God with the tongue depressor saying, say ah. And when you say ah, you will indict yourself. And in this context, he looks down the throat. And as he looks down the throat, he sees some vividly described things. He says, you open your mouth and I see an open grave. Isn't that complimentary? Doesn't that put man on a pedestal? That is man as he is. And if there's anything that man does not want to face today, is man as he is. But Romans says, I will tell you who you are and why you so desperately need my cross and my salvation. What do you think? Well, we got the extent, then we've got the depth down through verse 17. And without looking at verse 18, it will give the source of it all. Let your mind go back to Proverbs. What is the source of all wisdom? Remember the motto of Proverbs, Proverbs 1:7, that the what of God is the beginning of wisdom? Fear and respect for God is the beginning of wisdom. And notice verse 18, bottom line, source of it all, there is no fear of God before their eyes. And then he will shut the door in terms of salvation by any other means. But that's where we're going next time. The indictment, 14 points, extent, depth, and source. Father, we're thankful once again for your word. May we listen to what you have to say and seriously understand that this is truly the word of God. And this may not be, and this is not the verdict of man about man. It's not the verdict of psychology against man. It's not the verdict of sociology. It is the verdict of God. And we understand it as such in Christ's name.